KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It's been quite the roller coaster ride over the past month. You know, I think it's still really uncertain where the actual policy change is going to land in another 60, 90 days.
Where is the economy headed and what's around the next corner? Lots of experts are scratching their heads. For Saturday, May 3rd, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Coming up, we head to Rome to hear about the preparations for this week's conclave, from which a new pope will emerge. The rituals will be familiar, but this time with lots and lots of cardinals installed by Pope Francis who are first-timers.
He literally changed the institution. The conclave will have, for example, three Filipino cardinals. That's a first.
Plus, a new study looks to broaden our knowledge of psychedelic drugs.
There's a lot that we don't know still about how these drugs are used differently across the world.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The Trump administration has started canceling National Endowment for the Arts grants. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports this hours after President Trump proposed eliminating the agency entirely from the federal budget.
Hundreds of arts groups received emails either withdrawing or terminating their grants. Among those affected are the Berklee Repertory Theatre and the Chicago arts education nonprofit Open Studio Project. The email says the agency is updating its priorities to focus on projects that, quote, reflect the nation's rich artistic heritage and creativity as prioritized by the president. Julie Baker is the CEO of the arts advocacy group California for the Arts.
It just means that we've got to continue to mobilize and activate and try and convince the leadership to reverse these types of cuts.
The NEA did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
This week, President Trump removed Mike Waltz as his national security advisor, saying he plans to nominate him to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. In the meantime, Secretary of State Marco Rubio has been tapped to fill in as national security advisor temporarily while continuing his duties at state. NPR's Greg Myrie, though, says that might be hard to do.
The Secretary of State is in constant motion, traveling from one foreign capital to the next. In contrast, the national security advisor is usually quite close to the president. His natural habitat is the White House and the Situation Room in particular. His job is to work with various agencies, the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department, and help the president sort through policy options. So it's not a natural fit to do both jobs simultaneously.
NPR's Greg Myrie. Well, after 6 decades running Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett is planning to step down as CEO. And here's Maria Aspen has more.
At age 94, Buffett is one of the most powerful investors on Wall Street and beyond. The billionaire bought Berkshire Hathaway 60 years ago when it was a struggling textile mill. He's turned it into one of the largest companies in the world. Now, the Oracle of Omaha says he's about ready to step back. Buffett spent 4.5 hours answering shareholder questions on Saturday during his company's annual investor meeting. But he saved his big news for the very end, as broadcast by CNBC.
The time has arrived where Greg should become the chief executive officer of the company at year end.
Buffett designated Greg Abel as his successor years ago. Maria Aspen, NPR News, Omaha.
On a muddy track, but under dry skies, Sovereignty won the 151st running of the Kentucky Derby, the Run for the Roses, at Churchill Downs today. The horse had 9-1 odds entering the race. In second place, Journalism. You're listening to NPR News. The Trump administration is suing Denver and the state of Colorado, accusing the city and state and their leaders of interfering with federal efforts to enforce immigration laws in what are known as sanctuary cities. The Justice Department suit names the governor and the mayor as defendants in the latest attempt by the White House to get local governments to cooperate with President Trump's immigration agenda. The suit argues Colorado's sanctuary policies allowed a prison gang from Venezuela to take over an apartment complex near Denver. Local officials say that claim is exaggerated. The suit is similar to ones the administration filed against Illinois and Chicago and also Rochester, New York. Minecraft is a popular video game and now movie. It's also helping science. NPR's Regina Barber explains.
In the past, psychologists studied two modes of learning separately. You were either learning on your own or from another person. But cognitive scientist Charlie Wu and his team wanted to look at how these modes of learning interacted with each other. Wu and his team created scenarios with the video game Minecraft for over 100 participants. These scenarios had rewards clustered or randomly distributed, and this distribution altered how much players had to interact with others. This study found that the most successful players were the most adaptive, switching between individual mining and using social learning when the situation called for it. The findings were a new way to look at learning, and using Minecraft to do so was also unique. Wu and his team published this study in the journal Nature Communications. Regina Barber, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the University at Buffalo. The University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. It has been a month since President Trump announced his worldwide tariffs. Since then, there have been escalations and tariff retribution from other countries. Then tariff pauses, and now some of the pauses have run out, including the end of a loophole that allowed Americans to buy cheap goods directly from China and not pay tariffs. So that's a lot. But what data do we have so far? Well, the GDP in the U.S. contracted last quarter. The unemployment rate is holding steady, and employers added 177,000 jobs last month. Amid these mixed signals, we asked NPR Scott Horsley to help us understand how things are going. Hi, Scott.
I will do my best. It's not easy.
So, Scott, the economy shrank. Is that tariff-related?
Indirectly, yes. A big reason that GDP contracted in the first quarter was because there was a flood of imports, and that's because businesses and customers were trying to stock up ahead of the tariffs. Imports count against GDP, its gross domestic product. We also saw a general slowdown in consumer spending during the quarter, and that's, of course, the biggest driver of economic growth. And there's also just a lot of uncertainty right now. You know, economist Michael Puglisi of Wells Fargo says it's hard to know from day to day where this economy is headed.
It's been quite the roller coaster ride over the past month. The Liberation Day tariffs were announced, and then they were paused for 90 days. There's been exemptions for certain goods. There's been discussions of trade deals with specific countries. You know, I think it's still really uncertain where the actual policy change is going to land in another 60, 90 days.
There was a survey of factory managers that came out this past week, and one of the managers talked about supply chains being paralyzed because of all that uncertainty. Meanwhile, the cost of imported parts and raw materials has been going up, and factory orders have been going down.
I was talking to some union auto workers at a Trump rally in Michigan this week, and many of them say that tariffs are long overdue. So unions like tariffs. What about among American businesses? Any of them on the tariff bandwagon?
Yeah, some are. I think most businesses are not, but some businesses certainly are cheering for these tariffs. I talked to Tom Barr, who runs a company called TK Mold and Engineering in Romeo, Michigan. Mm-hmm. He makes injection molding equipment used by automakers and others. This is highly skilled work. His father and grandfather were in the same business.
I'd say about mold makers or anybody in the dye business or anything like that, we're the guys that coach the kids' teams. We're the guys that usher a church. We're the people that are like passionate about what we do.
And Barr would very much like to pass the business on to his kids. But, you know, in recent years, he's been facing increased competition from mold makers in China. He's seen what they can produce. It's good quality, he says sort of grudgingly. But even after crossing the ocean and being trucked to the Midwest, it is significantly cheaper than what he can make right there in Michigan.
So by the time they put it in the crate, put it on a boat, brought it to the Detroit area, It was $80,000, and that would have cost in U.S. funds $150,000. So how are we supposed to compete with that, right?
To Barr, Trump's triple-digit tariffs on Chinese imports are a lifeline that could help put him back in the game. Since those tariffs took effect last month, his phone's been ringing with potential customers calling about work they might send his way. But you hear those numbers he's talking about. These are big investments, so it's not a switch a company's going to make casually if they think these tariffs might go away in a month or two.
So, Scott, just quickly, are we in wait-and-see mode or are we in crisis mode?
You know, it varies, Don, from day to day. Consumers are pretty gloomy. They're worried about higher prices. They're worried about possible layoffs. Consumer confidence is about as low as it's been since the beginning of the pandemic. But that is not always a reliable guide to people's spending behavior. If people keep spending, then the economy will probably keep chugging along. If their spending droops as much as their mood has, well, then look out.
All right. That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
Always great to talk to you.
It's been 1 week since Pope Francis's funeral and burial. All things considered, host Scott Detrow is in Rome to cover the upcoming conclave. He visited the Church of St. Mary Major, the site of Francis's tomb, and has this report.
The line to see Pope Francis's tomb begins behind the basilica. Police and security guards herd visitors behind silver, red, and white barricades, which snake back and forth through the plaza and then around the side of the church. Some people are here intentionally for Francis. Others just happened to plan a trip to Rome that ended up falling in the middle of a papal transition.
I didn't know that there's still going to be, like, still ceremonies, like, a week later. I don't know. We were surprised.
Marlene Wickman and her husband Andre are in Italy with their children for a family wedding. They were moved by Francis's final appearance on Easter Sunday.
I was kind of impressed that he still would try to, you know, make it out for the Easter Mass. And, like, sometimes you do see that with the elderly. They have that last little bit of energy.
Katrina Keeler is ahead of them in line. She grew up Catholic in Pennsylvania, playing organ in the church.
My whole family's musicians. My dad went to Juilliard. He went to Manhattan School of Music. Growing up, it was like the Von Trapp family.
She says the family was so in demand for church services that around Christmas, her mom would come up with a master schedule of who was playing what instrument, where, and when.
But as I grew older, I felt like it was more the interpretations of the Bible from the Catholic religion that I feel like were really straying from what the main purpose, I guess, of a lot of the teachings were. I feel like a lot of it has kind of been weaponized, I guess, especially about with marginalized groups. So I definitely have not been following or practicing the Catholic faith anymore.
And when you're talking about marginalized groups, are you particularly talking about LGBTQ?
Yeah, I would definitely say LGBTQ, being part of that community as well.
She says she did appreciate Francis's more open and welcoming posture toward LGBT people. It was progress, she says, even if not as much as she'd hoped for. The basilica is large and ornate, but compared to St. Peter's Basilica, where so many other popes are buried, it feels much more quiet, more personal. Francis made frequent trips to the church to pray in front of a centuries-old icon of Mary and Jesus, an icon that over generations, Romans had developed close bonds to.
We're going into St. Mary Major now. We're going through one of the Jubilee doors throughout Rome that are open once every 25 years. 2025 was a Jubilee year. The idea, according to the church, is when you walk through the door, your sins are forgiven.
Inside, people line up along the left side of the church under an arched gold ceiling to wait for a moment in front of Francis's grave. Sometimes they're too loud, at least according to the church official with a microphone.
People are quietly waiting in line for a few moments in front of Pope Francis's grave, which is just 1 week old today. There's two police officers standing guard out front of it. The burial site is in a nave in between two confessional booths. The confessional booth to the left of it offers confessions in Spanish and Italian, the two languages Francis spoke the most.
A few feet away, Mass begins in a side chapel. It's a chapel where Francis came to pray before and after every major international trip. Trips where he carried out religious missions, like showing support for Catholics in countries where they make up a minority of the population, and trips with more political aims, like when he pressed global leaders to do more to support immigrants or counter climate change. The kinds of trips filled with moments and statements that can still stir emotions decades later.
And look, right now, the hair on my arms is standing.
Outside St. Mary Major, Andre is recalling how Pope John Paul II insisted on continuing to make public appearances, even as his Parkinson's disease grew worse and worse. Andre was also inspired by John Paul's opposition to communism. He grew up in Romania.
And he was Polish. He was working to undermine the communist regimes. His ideology, he was aligned with the way we felt there, because we wanted that regime gone, was inflicted on us by the Soviets, so we had nothing to do with it. So that's strong.
The selection of the next pope begins Wednesday.
That's NPR's Scott Detrow, who's in Rome to report on the upcoming conclave. Scott, can you just walk us through what's happening on that front this weekend?
You know, Don, a lot of it kind of mirrors the political process that you and I are used to covering. Cardinals have been meeting on a regular basis to talk through the big issues facing the church. And just like when lawmakers meet on Capitol Hill, there are always reporters outside gathered around trying to get quotes about how the meeting went. There's a lot of speculation right now, particularly in the Italian press, about who the front runners are. But we know from previous conclaves that those predictions, no matter how confident they are, they can change pretty quickly when all of the cardinals are gathered behind closed doors.
And for folks who maybe aren't following this all that closely or who aren't Catholic, just walk us through what happens next.
Yeah, the official mourning period for Francis wraps up tomorrow. These meetings of cardinals will continue, and they can have a pretty big impact on the outcome. Back in 2013, then Cardinal Bergoglio impressed his peers with a powerful speech about what the church should be focused on. A few days later, he was Pope Francis. So on Wednesday, the conclave begins. It begins with a mass and other formal ceremonies. That first day, there's just one ballot, one evening ballot. Cardinals are not allowed to talk while they're in the Sistine Chapel, but we know from Eberetti, who saw conclave, among other things, we know that once the vote takes place, once they hear who got votes for Pope, there's going to be a lot of conversations elsewhere that evening about what this contest actually looks like.
And just briefly, what are you going to be up to the rest of the week?
Yeah, of course, the big difference from those political conventions that we're used to covering is that here we aren't able to watch the floor proceedings, you know. So I'll be talking to people in and around St. Peter's Square about the big issues the church is facing, the ways that a pope can affect people who aren't Catholic, who aren't religious at all. And of course, I will be staring at that chimney on the top of the Sistine Chapel. If black smoke comes out, that means the ballot was inconclusive. If white smoke comes out, that means they have selected a pope.
Right. White smoke equals pope. That's NPR Scott Detrow in Rome. Scott, thank you.
Thanks, Don.
This is NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A federal judge has struck down President Trump's executive order targeting the prominent law firm of Perkins Coie, dealing a blow to Trump's campaign to punish law firms he considers his political enemies. The judge said Trump's order is an attack on the independence of the legal profession and the broader judicial system.
President Trump's 25% tariff on imported auto parts is now in effect, which is expected to have a major impact on the auto industry and customers' wallets. And at the Vatican, preparations are underway for the conclave to choose the next pope for the world's 1.4 billion Catholics. That includes the installation of the famous chimney atop the Sistine Chapel. It's scheduled to get underway on Wednesday. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. The conclave to elect the next pope begins in just a few days, and a lot of people are thinking about what it will mean for the future of the Catholic Church. One of them is Maria Ressa. She's a Nobel Peace Prize laureate and advocate for press freedom who gained notoriety for covering the brutal regime of Rodrigo Duterte, the former president of the Philippines. Ressa also met with Pope Francis multiple times, along with other Nobel Prize winners, to discuss some of the world's most pressing issues. My colleague Scott Detrow sat down with her recently to discuss the upcoming conclave and how the legacy of Pope Francis might shape it.
When you think about the papacy, this is a position that has, over the years, at times, reinforced income inequality, reinforced the patriarchy,
yeah,
and has also at points been a shining example of fighting for more equality, of fighting to include the poor, including the environment,
yeah,
you know. It depends on the person. It depends on the time. I'm wondering, you as somebody who spends so much time thinking about this rise of global authoritarianism, who thinks about the technology side of it, the government side of it, what to you is the role, the power of somebody in the papacy to set an agenda and to have such a prominent position to say things, to convene people? Like, what to you is the most important aspect of that?
It's 1.4 billion Catholics around the world. It's a large community. And let's just talk about some of the things you pointed out, what Pope Francis did, right? Like, the first was he connected income inequality with climate change. He pushed the boundaries to be as inclusive as possible. So whoever is selected by the conclave can push the church in either directions. Look, Pope Francis was a crucial conservative ally of progressive forces around the world.
What do you mean by that, a conservative ally of progressive forces?
Because the Catholic Church is conservative in general, right? Like, but it can go much further. It could be more progressive. And he had this, he tried to make life better for everyone.
There is a lot of worry among people who did cheer on or were heartened by Pope Francis's papacy. There is a lot of worry that the Catholic Church could go in the same direction that so many governments around the world have gone over the past decade.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you share that worry?
Absolutely. And you'll see this in who, as some of Pope Francis's own political battles inside the church were against the conservative bishops and cardinals, and some of them in America, right? So yes, of course, there's a rising tide globally, and that conclave will be important. But again, look how he changed the church by changing the makeup of the people of the conclave. And that's important. So again, when I've looked at some of the informal surveys that they've had, like, there are people who have been steeped, Pietro Parolin, the Secretary of State, and probably, you know, to people watching in the insiders, he's number one, but very close number two, a cardinal from the Philippines, who Pope Francis elevated through his power, right? Cardinal Tagle would not have been there.
I'd love to ask you about him because, like you said, he's on that list of half dozeners, and we truly have no idea historically sometimes, like Pope Francis, it's the person that nobody was focusing on. But like Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle, he was the Archbishop of Manila over the past decade or so. He has had a role in Rome. What should we know about him?
Number one, he's really funny. Number two, he's progressive values. He was criticized in the Philippines for not taking a strong enough position against Duterte, but he did speak out against it. And in many ways, he speaks from the heart, if that makes sense, right? Like, so I last saw him at the Vatican at the beginning of the Jubilee in January, and he chuckles. This is a man I know well. When I took over the largest news organization in the Philippines, he was part of our morning program. Starts the day cheerfully. He makes religion approachable to everyone.
You know, so much of the focus at this point, when a new pope has not been elected, and we know that 135 people are meeting in a very beautiful closed room to make a decision.
The conclave.
It's a geographic focus. Where should the next pope come from? Do you agree with the argument that the future of this institution is in Asia, is in countries like the Philippines?
It's hard for me. I mean, it's hard for me to answer something like that when, as a Filipino, of course I'll say yes.
Yeah.
But I would like a leader who takes us into the future, a pope who will not bring us back to the dark ages, who will take what Pope Francis has built. You know, it's funny, when he was asked about what his legacy is, he didn't respond. He said, my legacy is the church, right? So I hope for a church that is more inclusive, that gives us the spiritual guidance we all need in this crazy world today.
That is journalist and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Maria Ressa, who met several times with Pope Francis. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Cultures around the world have been using psychedelic substances for millennia. And if you've ever participated in that tradition, there's a group of researchers who want to hear about it. The 2025 Global Psychedelic Survey launched this week. Based at the University of Michigan, the survey aims to collect people's experiences using psychedelic substances like LSD, ibogaine, psilocybin, and others. For more, we've called Jacob Ade. He's the study's co-principal investigator and a researcher at the University of Michigan. Jacob, welcome.
Hey, Dad. Thanks for having me.
This isn't the first survey like this. There was another global psychedelic survey in 2023. Can you tell us what's different about this one?
For sure. Yeah. So I wasn't involved in the initial global psychedelic survey in 2023, but it was a really nice survey. They had about 6,000 participants in that initial survey, so a very large sample for this type of survey study. The major limitation was that it was only available in English, and so of course, a lot of the world's population doesn't speak English, and so this really limits our inclusivity and generalizability of the findings. And so really exciting thing with this new iteration of the survey is that it's going to be available in 18 languages, and we're hoping to get even more respondents than last time.
And why is a global perspective on psychedelics important?
Like you mentioned up front, people use psychedelics across the world and across diverse cultures. And it's really been a critical limitation to the psychedelic literature so far, especially clinical trials, is that participants have been very homogenous in terms of their demographic backgrounds. They've been overwhelmingly white, middle-aged, educated, and almost exclusively English-speaking. And so there's a lot that we don't know still about how these drugs are used differently across the world and what those differences might have on patient outcomes. And so it's really important that we have a more inclusive and representative sample when we're studying these drugs.
One of the criticisms that is swirled around psychedelic science is that the people producing the science are themselves advocates for legalization or medicalization. Just comment on that if you would.
I'd say that was probably a fair characterization very early in the recent psychedelic renaissance. The only people who were willing to put their professional credibility on the line for this really fringe and stigmatized area of research were people who were, so-called true believers in what these drugs could do. But as the field has scaled up the last few years, it's certainly not the case anymore that it's just those individuals carrying out the research.
You're really just getting started. What are you most hoping to learn from this survey, if you can say at this point?
I would say the key thing we're really interested in is, you know, how people are using these differently across cultures and how we can develop policy and harm reduction strategies to make sure people are using them most safely.
That was Jacob Ade, co-principal investigator for the Global Psychedelic Survey 2025. The survey is open now through May 16th. Jacob, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The Afrobeat musician Femi Kuti has a new album out. It's called Journey Through Life. The album draws inspiration from jazz, funk, and West African music. And it pays homage to the Afrobeat sound that Femi's father, Fela Kuti, helped create in the 1960s. Kuti spoke to us from his home in Nigeria. We discussed his inspiration for the album and asked him to describe a few standout tracks.
I thought it was important I talked about things that have guided me through my life. So I came up with the title Journey Through Life.
As you pass through your journey in life, remember this is just for a period of time. Don't hold on to material things too tight. Just gather up to let you after a while. Keep all of your loved ones by your side.
Let me sing about virtues that I stand by and try to focus on to lead me in my life, family, and tolerance and things like this. So it was hard to put it in not too long a song, but catchy and meaningful. There's another track called Work on Myself.
Maybe we fit, no change the world, or we can change the world within us. I'm gonna work on myself and bring out the very, very best.
And it's a summary of my state of mind, really, at this time, politically, socially. And since I can't pick up a gun or anything to be violent, and I'm really frustrated with global politics. And sometimes you just feel helpless. So I was thinking to myself that maybe the problem really is not trying to change the world, but trying to change yourself.
Before I say the road to freedom, then yeah. As many great people don't work out, this is work out. I say the work out small, things go better. But now I say the road to freedom, they far.
The best way to solve a lot of issues is for one to look inwards, develop yourself physically, spiritually, mentally, because at the end of the day, you are accountable to this, if there is life after death, of course.
Yes, I'm gonna work on myself. Yes, I'm gonna work on myself. Yes, I'm gonna work on myself.
After 24 years is, well, it's one of the favorites we play right now at the Shrine. It's kind of slow, and again, it's a summary of the political situation in Nigeria that it's really addressing this situation, but pinpointing time. This now focuses on time.
Years on, our government never perform. Them just the government they chop. From 1999 we they talk. They fail to repair our refineries. They pretend with their rivalries. They sit down together, they enjoy. While the country they destroy. 11,000.
Everything's kind of slow, but you have a very melodious horn line. Ba, 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 da, da, ba, ba, ba. It's a very kind of sing-along. Music like this I like because when you sing about something very hard, this sweet melodious horn line catches the listener to want to listen. It's very important to find very sweet melody. So consciously or subconsciously, the listener will hear the message.
That was musician Femi Kuti. His latest album, Journey Through Life, is out now. This is NPR News. Ever sit down to read a book, get half a page in, and realize nothing has sunk in? Or maybe you even finished a book and later thought, I don't really remember anything about it. Under the best of circumstances, deep reading is hard, even harder with a device in your pocket that's constantly just clamoring for attention. But if you want to get better at it, our Life Kit team put together this guide on reading deeper. Here is NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Marianne Wolfe has written a number of books about the science of reading. Her latest is Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. And she's a big advocate of deep reading, which means what exactly?
At the heart of it is the point where we, the reader, go beyond the wisdom of the author to discover our own.
Wolfe says it is something that we've all done to a certain extent, you know, get completely immersed in a text, bring our own thoughts and opinions to it. But it's hard to do, particularly if you do most of your reading on a screen.
The screen itself is a source of attention disruption. And by that I mean we have so much information that we have a built-in defense mechanism. We skim.
And skimming is the enemy of deep reading. So if you really want to read deeply, step away from the screen and give print a shot. This doesn't have to be just for books. You know, Wolf prints out articles she needs for work or contracts she needs to comb over. And if you're out of practice deep reading, it's going to take time and discipline to get it back. A few years ago, Wolf tried to reread a Hermann Hesse book she once loved and found that she just couldn't lock in.
I was very stubborn. My mind was almost protesting stubbornly. I don't want to read this.
Also, for listeners, in your book, there's a funny moment where you're like, maybe this book is just bad.
Exactly. Yeah. You are so right. I mean, that was a piece of it. I was stubbornly rejecting the book and thinking, you know, I hate to say it on NPR, but I said, who in the world gave him a Nobel Prize for this? You know?
Wolf says it was as if she was fighting against her own inclination to skim. So the answer was to slow down.
For 2 weeks, I forced myself to read 20 minutes a day to try to be that older version of a reader. Each of us, if we're serious, can ferret 20 minutes of our day away and try to read at the pace of the book. And different books demand different paces.
Wolf says don't be too concerned with the rate of books you're reading. We're looking for quality over quantity here. As for remembering the things you read, Wolf says if you're deep reading, your mind has a way of storing that information, even if it feels like it's beyond your recollection.
There is more memory that consolidates than we have immediate perceptible access to. On the other hand, when we skim, we consolidate less.
But to really savor something you read and help encase a quote or thought or idea in your memory, write it down.
I write on the margin, and then I write in the back of the book the pages of the most important insights for me.
Obviously, only do this for books you own. Do not start defacing library books, please. That wouldn't help anybody deep read. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
For more tips from Life Kit, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
American ports are bracing for President Trump's tariffs. We'll look at what it means when the number of cargo ships arriving starts to dwindle. Plus, are you sure you're taking your pain medications the right way? We'll tell you what you need to know. Those stories, plus books, movies, music, and of course, the puzzle, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett says he plans to step down as CEO of Berkshire Hathaway at the end of the year. At the annual shareholder meeting in Omaha today, the 94-year-old also said the Trump administration shouldn't use trade as a weapon. Top officials in the Trump administration are criticizing Germany for classifying the Alternative for Germany party as right-wing extremist. That paves the way for monitoring of the party. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says it's tyranny in disguise. And United Airlines is blaming equipment failures and air traffic control staffing issues for its decision to cut the number of flights out of New Jersey's Newark Airport. United says it will cut around 35 round-trip flights a day starting this weekend. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Capital One, with the Capital One Saver Card, what's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. Okay. Have you heard the term the broligarchy?
We're seeing a rise in what I guess we'll call the broligarchy.
The broligarchs really have an explicit political agenda.
How do you survive the broligarchy?
That was Kevin Hurton on Al Jazeera's The Take, sociologist Brooke Harrington on The Daily Show, and Bridie Jabour of The Guardian Australia. The broligarchy is a term that refers to the rich, well-connected tech bros now flexing real power inside the Trump administration. CEOs like Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, Sundar Pichai of Google, both of which are among NPR's financial sponsors, and others like Jeff Bezos and, of course, Elon Musk. It's clear that these broligarchs have enormous influence, not just in tech, but now in politics. What's less clear is their agenda, ideology, and the path that brought them to this moment. Member station KQED's Internet Culture podcast, Close All Tabs, recently released a two-part series about the broligarchy, and host Morgan Sung joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Morgan, first, what sparked your interest in making this series?
Well, so the broligarchy is this portmanteau of bro and oligarchy, which felt like the most accurate description of the people in power right now. And obviously it's a tongue-in-cheek phrase, but it does point to something really serious. And like a lot of listeners, during inauguration, we watched Elon Musk on stage doing what appeared to be a Nazi salute. And we were like, well, how did we get here? And so the goal of Close All Tabs is to provide context and help people understand that this moment that we're having isn't happening in a vacuum. And so we started to look into Elon Musk's roots, which inspired the episode on the PayPal Mafia.
Okay, who is the PayPal Mafia?
So that's the nickname for this group of tech bros. They were all co-founders, executives, engineers, and other employees at PayPal in the early 2000s. You have Elon Musk, David Sachs, who's the White House crypto czar. You have Peter Thiel, another legendary investor. And after they left PayPal and became very rich because of the sale to eBay, they went on to found a ton of other companies within Silicon Valley, and they invested in each other's companies. They were sitting on each other's boards. They were advising each other. So the idea was, if you wanted to get your foot in the door in Silicon Valley, you had to get in with the PayPal mafia. And so the name comes from this 2007 Fortune magazine feature that literally calls them the PayPal mafia in the headline. And they all posed for this absurd photo shoot.
And we have a clip from the podcast where you describe that photo shoot. Let's listen.
The cover photo features 13 of them, all men, of course, cosplaying as seedy New Jersey mobsters. They're dressed in tracksuits, leather jackets, or big boxy sports coats with the shoulder pads. They've got the chunky gold chains, of course, and their hair is slicked back, and they're surrounded by poker chips and glasses of whiskey. A few of them are puffing on cigars. It's a scene straight out of The Sopranos.
It's a stereotype, and it's offensive. There is no mafia.
Today, this photo shoot might be considered an offensive caricature of Italian-American gangsters, but it's 2007. It was a direct reference to the biggest show on TV at the time.
So once you started looking into all of the people in this photo that you described, what did you find out about them?
Well, some of the core members of the PayPal mafia, including Elon Musk, were born in South Africa during apartheid. They did grow up with immense privilege and wealth in an extremely authoritarian regime. And so we dug into those ties in the first part of our Broligarchy series.
So let's dive a little more into the Broligarchy, in particular Elon Musk. In your reporting, have you come across any ideas from Silicon Valley or elsewhere that really seem to shape how Musk thinks about governance?
Yeah, so we were throwing around a couple of terms that we were seeing on social media. But we talked to a historian of technology and politics, Margaret O'Meara, and she explained why one that we thought was the most accurate, techno-fascism, didn't quite fit the situation. Techno-fascism specifically refers to this concept that relies on bureaucracy to function, with academics and technical experts in charge. And so Doge is, you know, headed by Elon Musk, and they are slashing that very bureaucracy. And so Margaret introduced us to a concept that she thought would fit this kind of ideology a bit better, and that was techno-optimism.
Describe just what that means, techno-optimism.
So it's the idea that technological innovation will save humanity and that nothing should ever stand in the way of tech progress, especially not the government, which seems to be embodied by Elon Musk and several other members of the Broligarchy right now. And so a lot of these beliefs are laid out in something called the Techno-Optimist Manifesto. It's this lengthy blog post kind of essay written by venture capitalist Marc Andreessen. He was a co-founder of one of the early internet browsers, Netscape. And after Netscape, he went on to found a pretty legendary venture capital firm and invested in a ton of companies. He's become a kind of kingmaker within Silicon Valley. That's what he's called.
And the thesis statement, if we can call it that, of your podcast is to make sense of internet and tech culture. Mm-hmm. Why is it so important to you to look at how the so-called Broligarchy affects us in real life?
Well, this goes beyond tech policy. Right now, the Broligarchy has real political power. And so we wanted to look into where the roots of their beliefs came from, and what those beliefs are and how they might be shaping our current government right now.
All right, Morgan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Morgan Sung is the host of Close All Tabs, a podcast from KQED Studios in San Francisco. You can listen to full episodes of Close All Tabs wherever you get your podcasts. Over the past few months, Ukraine has been caught in geopolitical jostling at the highest echelons of power. Just this week, the Trump administration signed a deal to share revenues from Ukraine's mineral wealth, tying the U.S. even more closely to negotiations over the country's future. But these are political machinations. What about daily life on the ground in Ukraine, more than 3 years after the Russian invasion? Well, Kyiv, the capital, is bustling, at least by day.
It's a city that's absolutely alive and full of creativity and resilience. There's wonderful coffee shops, wonderful restaurants. You see people on the streets all the time during the day. People going to work, kids going to school.
That's Joanna Kakissis, NPR's correspondent in Ukraine.
On weekends, I'll go to the theater. We'll walk along the Dnipro River. You'll see these elderly couples dancing on the shore, like doing the waltz. And, you know, and you think, like, this doesn't feel like a city at war. But every night, practically, there are drone attacks. You're, like, jarred awake by the fact, like, oh, yeah, this is war. We're at war, and it's happening practically every night.
This is the strange duality of life in Ukraine right now, the daily rhythm that's hard to grasp from just following news of the latest political negotiations. So for our weekly Reporter's Notebook segment, we wanted to get on the ground with Joanna, who's been living and working in Ukraine for almost the entire war. We'll pass it off here to our co-host, Scott Detrow, who started by asking Joanna about those near-nightly aerial attacks.
People in the early months, everyone, an air raid siren would come and the whole city would troop down to air raid shelters.
Yeah.
Does that still happen after several years of this?
Not that many people go like they used to go. In the beginning, it was every time. Now it's not as often. People have just gotten really used to it. I remember interviewing this woman who said that she was so tired after days and days of not sleeping that even though the explosion like was rattling her windows and actually blew out one of her windows, she didn't want to go downstairs to the shelter. She's just like, honestly, I don't care if I die. I'm just too tired. I'm too tired. I need to sleep. It's really worn people down, the fact that they hear this every night. So, and they've just gotten used to it, as have I.
So that's life in Kyiv. What is the best way to describe what it's like when you leave the capital, when you go elsewhere in the country, especially as you move more toward the Eastern Front, where the active, increasingly trench warfare war is taking place?
Right, right. You can really tell there's a big difference. When I'm in Kharkiv or in the Donetsk region, I definitely notice the difference. And for one, there are many, many more explosions. And you also have the fear of something called guided bombs, like glide bombs, which are very, very destructive. And Kharkiv has suffered from a lot of them. And I've also visited Kherson there because the Russians are also nearby there. They'll send over drones that like attack people, like hunt them down and attack them on the street. So it's much more dangerous. I know a couple in Kherson who I've been in touch with for a while. He's a journalist and she's an illustrator, and she hasn't left the house in 2 years because she's too afraid to leave her apartment.
You know, it's such a strange war, and I'm wondering how you see this from your perspective, because in some ways it is a very old style of war, right? With this static battlefield and trenches and landmines. And then it is a war that is being fought in so many ways by this modern technology, like both sides aggressively using drones and fighting a war that way.
Yeah, that's true. It's incredibly modern in some ways and incredibly World War I in other ways. Drone warfare is really the main stage right now. I'm not saying that infantry don't have a role anymore, but drones are increasingly becoming the weapon of choice by both sides. And especially, you know, the Ukrainians have invested a lot of money in making cutting-edge drones or using drones in cutting-edge ways because, let's remember, the Ukrainians are vastly outnumbered by the Russians. There are many more Russian soldiers than there are Ukrainian soldiers. And Ukrainians can't lose soldiers. So to them, investing in warfare that will help them get an edge on the battlefield without losing more soldiers or investing more soldiers, that's where it's at for the Ukrainians.
And I understand you recently did some reporting where you saw some of these new drones up close, specifically something called a land drone. Tell me what a land drone is.
I saw two of them, actually, I should explain. Let's start with the big drone. The big drone is like, looks like a truck with six wheels, and it's about the size of a large bumper car at an amusement park, if you can think of that. And then there's a small drone that looks kind of like a child's play truck, like one where a little person could fit, you know, sort of use a steering wheel to move it around, although there is no steering wheel on this one. The big drone carries supplies in. It has like, you know, ammunition, it has food, it has, you know, whatever the soldiers need, they load it up and they send it in there. The smaller drone, that one is just filled with explosives, and it's got a one-way mission, and it's to kill the enemy. So it's sent in there, and the explosives are detonated once they're close to Russian infantry.
Tell me a little more about the specific unit that you spent time with these land drones.
Sure. They were part of the Kharkiv Brigade, which is based in the northeastern city of Kharkiv, and it's like part of Ukraine's National Guard. It's got a lot of innovators in its ranks, like a lot of young men in their 20s with PhDs in mathematics and engineering and molecular biology. I spent a lot of time with this 26-year-old evolutionary biologist whose military call sign is Pan, like the Greek god of shepherds and hunters. And he had this thick black hair and a gaze that just reflected a lot of steeliness and a lot of pain. He'd lost close friends in the war, and he's from part of Ukraine in the east that's been under relentless attack. And he told me a lot about how these land drones work, because he himself has modified them so they can work for Ukraine.
What is he doing right now? He's setting up
his equipment for testing.
Okay.
We are testing how far can it go. Our war is a competition between quantity and quality, and we are quality. It is not only because we have no choice, it is also because we have a capability to use such technology. We have smart people who can use it.
Joanna, I want to end with this. This war has been going on for more than 3 years now. I'm wondering how you approach this beat and how you think about finding new stories in a war that just keeps going on, and how you fight the fatigue on your end and how you think about it editorially.
Well, I think the challenge is that you still have to keep up with the news, and there's only one of me, so the news is always takes precedent. But what I really want to do, and what I really try hard to find time to do, is to tell stories about people. This is about human beings and how they're living through it.
I was giving them the food, and they were like crying because they said that I had no food for the 3 days because I was running from the bombing. And
this isn't a war just about, you know, politics or who kicked who out of the Oval Office or, you know, things like that.
Because of the attacks, I am very worried. So is my family. But I live close to the subway, and so the way to rehearsals is also underground.
It's very hard for me to sit here while my fellow soldiers are out there. This is my country, and if I don't defend it, who will?
You know, at the end of the day, I don't need to listen to politicians and to policy wonks so much. I need to talk to people, because it's people who are experiencing this.
That is NPR's Ukraine correspondent, Joanna Kakissis. Thanks so much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
For Saturday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. We're back tomorrow and hope you'll join us. Until then, thank you for listening and have a great night.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the University at Buffalo, the University at Buffalo is developing new AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org. We'll be right back.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.